Accession number 30260, Reel 7.
This is the fourth reel I'm taking dinner with Ernie Banks in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 31st of the 8th, 2007, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Ernie, I wanted to talk to you about your early missions. You were mentioning that the first two is sort of observation, infiltration, that sort of thing, trying to find out what's going on. What were you observing? What were you able to glean about the enemy?
Well, in the early missions, I landed in two islands of Indonesia, important islands, the big one, Sumatra, and the other one in the Malacca. Now, my aim, the reason I was dropped, was to find out if the Japs were there purely for occupation, no reasons, troops to occupy it and make sure that everyone behaved, or were they preparing for invasion? That was what I wanted to find out. And they told me, you can soon find out, if they were going to invade, you would see very big troop movements, equipment movement, and things like that. If, on the other hand, they're just occupational troops, and specifically if the troops look fairly elderly in comparison from being very young and trained, you know that they were for occupation purposes. So that was the main aim that we were doing. I would stay in the mountain daytime, and at nighttime we'd come out and we would look at the main streets, look at the cafes, and see what we could. We tried to get closer to their place where they lived, and see if there was a lot of equipment there. And we found that in those places there didn't seem to be any way looking like huge troop movement for invasion, but purely for occupation only. And that was our purpose, and that is what we achieved and what we were sent for there. And that started off to have what our aim was and what we did. Then later on, that was extended to other duties, but that came in much later.
Obviously, the main concern to people in Australia would be, are the Japanese going to come or planning to come to Australia?
That's right.
People talk of occupation money and finding, chests.
We didn't. There always was occupation money. What was Dutch money with stamp printed on it that were Japanese legal money now. And they could use that. That was the money that they used. We personally couldn't use it because we didn't make contact because of the danger, the population being anti.
But people talk of finding Australian occupation pounds, that sort of thing, being concerned that the Japanese were preparing this invasion. And people talk of finding Japanese helmets on Garden Island, all of those sorts of things.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I can only talk about my own experience. And as my own experience, I have never noted any Australian money or so in the places we were, or was used as legal tendency in anywhere. I've never seen anything like that.
Were there any obvious signs that...
There were more obvious signs that they were not invading than they were invading.
Such as?
We were, for example, the fact that they were all comparatively elderly troops that seemed to be very well settled in and just looking after the population. And there was no sign that they were going to move on or big activities. So in my reports, I always wrote, if this is going to happen, it's certainly not going to happen where I was. But as you know how big Indonesia is, so many islands, that wasn't necessarily mean that there wasn't even on the islands we were, there wasn't even an activity, much activities of building aerodromes, what you would expect if they were going to invade. There was nothing like that. It was just a local aerodrome that was used for sometimes Japanese officials and coming in and going out, but nothing on even extending it for big planes. In especially where it was only a small airfield, and they used small planes to land there. But there was no activity at all that showed that they were going to invade.
Well, people talk of the Kokoda track and the importance of saving Port Moresby and the Japanese wanting to make a base at Port Moresby and then invade Australia from there. In your experience, obviously you're mentioning that in your experience you didn't see anything like that, but was there this fear that you sensed or you were told about that people really seriously thought the Japanese were on their way?
That fear was very much so in Australia. When I came back, you know, that fear from the top of the military to the civilians was enormous, you know, they're going to invade us. And I think that came about because of the constant bombing up north, like Darwin, Catherine, all those places were regularly bombed. And if they weren't bombed, they were flying over it and had good looks and what it was like. We could count practically that around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you would see these silver planes, 9, flying over. And I think there was an enormous fear and also a bit of a complex that they knew they had nothing to defend themselves. So that didn't help. So in Australia, that was always the first thing we asked, you know, are they going to invade us? Are they going to invade us? What do you think? You know, what did you note? And that sort of thing. But I have never, in where I landed, found any at all evidence that they were going to invade. That doesn't mean, as I say, there are very many islands, very big islands, just because that small group where I landed, but even the colleagues of mine, one or two that I did sort of get to talk to, said the same thing. We didn't notice anything. So in that way, the fear came more from Australia than actually it showed. I think they were very, very overawed by the fact that the Japanese had made such a quick and fast trek right through Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia. And they thought, this is going to go on. But realistically speaking, where I was, I never saw any boat movement, because you need a lot of shipping if you want to get across, or train, well, they didn't have trains where I was, but truck movement or truck that showed that they were going to invade.
You mentioned that you went to Aceh at one point and were talking to the extremist fundamentalist Muslim community there. What was your following operation? When you came back from that, you obviously got out of that one. What was your next operation? Do you remember?
The next operation that I did was a totally different operation. I was practically, I had a feeling that they didn't want me for a while in that area because it all was stopped because of political reasons. The Australians were very keen to follow that up, of course, but the Allies, the Dutch, who were the original people of it was their colonies, they said, no, if they don't want to talk to us and don't do things about us, then we don't want to have anything to do. And that stopped it. And because I was the main negotiating in those days, they felt that they're better for me not to land. So I went down and came right from the top of Sumatra. My next mission was down south, right down below, around Palembang. And the mission there was on Palembang, not Palembang itself, but on the Musi River there, near Palembang, there were two huge oil refineries. One island was called Sungai Gerong, the other island was called Plaju. Sungai Gerong was run by the Standard Oil Company in America, but they gave it a Dutch name, the Netherlands Colonial Petroleum Company. The other one was pure Dutch and was run by Royal Shell, and that was Plaju, two islands. And then from there, about 100 kilometers up north in the jungle, they had the oil fields. And they transported those oil from the oil fields to the two refineries, very big refineries, where they turned it into kerosene and petrol, and then big tankers would come up the Musi River, was very deep, loaded up and went away. Now I was asked if there was any way we could sabotage those two fields. And we were able to get in there because not far from the last island, Sungai Gerong, from the NKPM, or the Standard Oil Factory, was a colony of lepers. And that was looked after by a man and a woman, Salvation Army, Germans actually, Germans, but they had been there for something like 15 years, and they both had contracted the disease. And no Jap came near those islands because they were scared they're going to get it, get the leprosy. So we were able to get in there by sub and then row up a last two case and get on that little island that was part of it. Actually, it wasn't an island because it was connected to Sungai Gerong and on a road. And were there for a while to see. But it was such a colossal big refineries. How could you with two or three people do damage? They then said, what about if we could set up a signal post in the trees so that planes could beam in on that, then fly over and drop bombs. What they actually did. But again, in those days, the bombs were not as big as they now or even were in the end of the war. And the damage that was done was just not worthwhile the trouble, because the risk for an aircraft carrier to go there to launch the planes was too big, as they explained to me later, because we still wouldn't have 100% control of the sea. So if those aircraft carrier, and that would have been an English aircraft carrier, not the big ones, the American, coming from Trincomalee, from where they had their base, that's the English base, was too risky. So that thing was dropped. But that was my next mission, to see if that was possible. And we were there for about 10 days, looked at all sorts of ways, but found there was no way. We still couldn't trust the natives there, because that was a different... There was still Sumatra, but there was still different natives. And they were working just normally as the Dutch were and the Americans were. It was working very well, but we could not see that we could do sufficient damage to them to stop production. What they did do, I believe, I was told, but I'm not sure about this, that they, near the mouth of the Musi River, they constantly, but they didn't even could do that properly. They didn't have enough subs there, and if they saw a tanker come out, they would torpedo it. But again, they didn't even have enough in those early days submarines, British submarines, to sit there and wait for the come. But I think that was very soon stopped. They couldn't get the oil out of Sumatra into Japan.
presumably, too, you only had limited time that you could sneak around these oil refineries.
Yes, again, at night time, try to get as close as possible.
How well guarded were these places?
Not extremely well guarded, because they didn't expect anything, because so isolated. I would say it was as much guarded as the average place in Australia or everywhere, like the shipping company or an airfield was guarded in Australia, was guarded there. They have mainly barbed wire around the place, and then they would have a guard sitting there half asleep at night time, and well, there was nothing to do, and that was all. It was quite easy for us to penetrate and to go and have a look. The only danger was being a small island, and the people would be sleeping at night. There's nobody around, and if they see you walking around, you would show up a bit, so you had to be very careful that way. But we soon realized that it seemed to be running all quite well. Regularly, you saw the ships coming in. They seemed to be getting the oil, you know. And we could observe that from where we were, practically. And it seemed to carry on as it was before, what we were told. Except that, of course, where there were the white people in the houses, there were no Japanese in the people. And they did bring their experts in from Japan. That was one thing, because the Indonesians didn't have the knowledge. And, of course, the Dutch and the Americans and British that were working there as were all in concentration camp and taken away from the islands and from Palembang. There was a big prison thing in Palembang, what was 14 k's away from those islands. Again, connected to the road, but you had to go across the Musi River to the other side. And then you could take a car, and they had cars that took them to Palembang. And Palembang, there was a very big prison camp that was used by the Dutch for prisoners, you know, just normal prisoners, but they were full of internees they have. And then they slowly moved them from there to other parts, but we never knew who. Mm-hmm.
You're mentioning to me, too, that you were to observe how prisoners were being treated in certain situations. What do you recall of things like that?
We were not very successful in that. Because we couldn't get sort of into the camps, and because we couldn't talk with other people around it, we just had to do observation. And you can just imagine the observation you make. You'd be in the dark, or you'd be sitting, and you see a man walking, you know, a bit thinner or so, and a woman up there, or a man, or a group. Well, what can you deduct from it? Well, they seem to be alive. They don't look very happy, but, you know, it was. We didn't have proof that they were treated that badly. Although they were, but we hadn't imagined it, and we couldn't see by just the movement of them. We just thought that they looked, in many cases, very thin. That's all we could sort of observe. And that was just a by thing we did do several times. But they didn't seem to be what we could see. We never seen, for example, the Japanese, when they went out for a working party, hitting them or so. They might have done it, but when I was observing, I never saw that.
Mm. What were you able to glean from the general atmosphere in places like this, and how the locals were sort of perceiving the occupation? You mentioned that
the locals perceived the occupation as a godsend of getting away from afterwards from the Dutch occupation.
You're mentioning that they hated you even more than
they hated. What we definitely found is that they They always go for strength, the natives in those countries. It's a part of their philosophy, we found. It doesn't matter if they were mainly Muslims, or even if they were not religious enough, but Muslims, but not following their land. The Asian people always looks up at strength.
Presumably, too, and we can talk about this as we go on, they were looking up another Asian country, or an Asian man at least, sort of
yes,
outdoing
well, that's,
the Westerner.
Well, that's funny. That was working against us to say that an Asian country could defeat a white country. But that didn't. They didn't look upon them as being closer. They just looked at them, they're strength, they're strong, they kicked the white people out, so they must be fantastic, and they obeyed them, hoping that one day they might still be able to even kick them out too. But they didn't look further than that. But there was certainly a complete hate, and not only hate, but a complete, how could you express that, a complete feeling of, God, you're useless, these white people. How have they been able for 400 years, you know, making out that they were so marvelous?
Yeah. People obviously talk of how the Japanese treated the Chinese in places like Singapore. Did you ever experience anything along those lines? You know,
we found that on the whole, the Japanese treated the Chinese, especially the small businessmen, left them alone because they needed them for the food supply. They were the main source of handling food supply, rice especially. And the natives, they left them alone in consequence because they needed them to do the laboring work and things. But they had no conscience of taking 1,000 natives if they wanted to build, say, a railway line or something away, and then they were treated very badly.
Did you see evidence of that? I mean, people talk, obviously, of the Burma Railway and the way...
Yes, well, we were not in that area, of course, but where we were, we found that the natives on the whole had to fetch themselves for food and try to get food. And if they didn't work very hard for the Japanese, they would be, as they call, smacked or treated very badly. I've never seen it, but they just worked very, very hard, and they didn't take much notice of them. They treated them as absolute nothing. They were more respectful towards the Chinese businessmen. They left them alone because they were the ones that fixed up the normal things like food for them and handling. And it was later on when we found out that the Chinese were able to work for us for money, for gold, that we really got some great things done. But the natives were treated a lot worse under the Japs than actually under the Dutch. But they hated the Dutch so much because of the past.
So following this observation of the fuel, the oil refineries, do you recall the next operation for you, the next mission?
Let me see, that was Operation Singo, and then we went